keeping domestic production and the economy afloat, amid the toughest sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Iran. He said, thanks to those efforts, the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran has hit the wall, and that's what American officials have also admitted. Addressing the government officials present in the meeting, Ayatollah Khamenei put major emphasis on the need to avoid tying the economy to the outcome of the ongoing Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran deal. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution believes the ultimate solution to the country's economic problems is to rely on the young minds. As he said, they have proved competent in all areas, from the production of COVID vaccines to precision-guided missiles. It's the second time in almost 2 years that Iran's leader has met with Iranian producers. Ayatollah Khamenei has on different occasions highlighted the need to boost domestic production as the key to resistance economy. To this end, he has taken symbolic and practical measures, including naming the current Persian year the year of production, support, and the elimination of obstacles, calling on authorities to materialize this slogan. Boosting domestic production has been one of the main concerns and priorities of Iran's leader. Today, he once again urged the Iranian government to not wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions to fix the economy, and instead capitalize on local producers, as he believes this is the only way toward a resilient economy that can withstand foreign pressures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a rally near the separation fence between Gaza and the occupied lands. The rally comes to voice the Palestinian outrage of the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. And Naqab is witnessing a wave of forced displacement by Israel's system of apartheid against all Palestinians. Considering these Israeli attempts to expel thousands of Palestinians from their homes and lands a crime against humanity, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip expressed their support to Palestinians in Naqab, south of the country.
The Israeli regime has stolen our land since 1948. Until this moment, it keeps practicing apartheid attempts to take our lands by force. My words for Palestinians in Naqab is that we will always be supported and we are all united in the face of this aggression.
In their speeches, Palestinian factions stressed that the issue of Naqab is the issue of every Palestinian and they won't sit idle in the face of these illegal crimes.
This event is organized by the national and the Islamic forces in Gaza and all the Palestinian tribesmen in order to express our support to our people in Naqab, who are under the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. Israel wants to expel those people from their lands and homes, and this is unacceptable for us. We are together until breaking the Zionist Bennett, who threatened to build an iron wall around our people in Naqab.
Calling it an ongoing Nakba, hundreds of Palestinian citizens demonstrated in Naqab, while dozens of them were arrested by the Israeli regime. The number of Arab citizens in Naqab is estimated at 300,000, living on 5% of the land, of which they said that Israel had confiscated 95% since 1948. Naqab has seen a dramatic escalation as the Israeli regime intensifies its apartheid policies of seizing the Palestinian lands. Palestinians here stress that Naqab is not alone in this struggle. They also say they won't remain silent in this battle against the Israeli crimes. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Mattarella. After 6 days of failed votes and 8 rounds of ballots, on Saturday the Italian parliament re-elected 80-year-old Sergio Mattarella as president of the republic with 759 votes out of 983 cast by the grand electors. In the days ahead of the election, Mattarella, who has been in office since 2015, had repeatedly said that he didn't want another stint. However, he changed his mind on Saturday afternoon when the leaders of parliamentary groups resorted to him in a desperate attempt to put an end to a political impasse that would erode the nation's credibility. The political stalemate was triggered by parties' disagreement over the candidacy of Prime Minister Draghi to be the next president earlier in the week. In the following days, parties struggled to reach an agreement over an alternative figure, dragging the country on the verge of a political crisis. Commentators have slammed political leaders for their bickering over a consensus candidate. Some have said that not even during a pandemic crisis which has brought the country to its knees, political parties have been able to put aside their differences. Prime Minister Draghi is expected to reshuffle his cabinet as his first move following Mattarella's election. He has to make sure that the 260 billion euros that Italy is receiving from the European Recovery Fund to counter the economic fallout of the COVID-19 crisis are spent effectively. Draghi has committed to 58 reforms and 132 investments over the next 5 years. Max Civili, Rome.
Cheering for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, thousands of locals in southern Damascus welcomed high-ranking security officers who arrived in Kiswe town to initiate a reconciliation process that would lead to providing amnesty to those wanted by security apparatus during the crisis and implementation of presidential amnesty decrees.
There's an amnesty decree by President Bashar al-Assad today to start a reconciliation campaign in the countryside. Tomorrow, the campaign will cover all Damascus countryside for all misled Syrians. The importance of such a campaign is its contribution in restoring peace.
We conveyed the demands of the people in Damascus countryside for reconciliation to President Assad, who ordered the formation of a security committee that includes the military prosecution and all security apparatus to solve the problems of the people and settle their situation.
Hundreds of wanted people flocked to reconciliation centers to settle their situation. Some had escaped military duty, while others were involved in anti-government acts or were members of armed groups in the past.
We were outlaws. We came to reconcile. We were misled like many Syrians. Everyone makes mistakes. We came today to be on the right track with our homeland thanks to President Assad.
This is the most comprehensive reconciliation deal south of the capital. Over 2,700 individuals had reconciled in southern Damascus since 2016. Thousands more currently have the chance to return to normal life in the next week. The Syrian government has for years prioritized reconciliation deals over military solutions in areas that have witnessed violence throughout the unrest. Such deals lay the foundation for negotiated settlement of the crisis facing the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's promises to curb civilian casualties are as empty as the military's vows to stop sexual harassment, says Peter Moss, journalist, in an article published under the heading Pentagon Prophesies Shock that U.S. Airstrikes Frequently Kill Civilians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Pentagon is not known for staging revivals of classic movies, but it just reenacted a famous scene from Casablanca. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, after months of news reports about civilians killed by U.S. bombs, including the death of 7 children and 3 adults in a Kabul drone attack, just issued a directive to reduce what the military traditionally describes as collateral damage. "We can and will improve upon efforts to protect civilians," Austin vowed recently, adding, "The protection of innocent civilians in the conduct of our operations remains vital to the ultimate success of our operations and as a significant strategic and moral imperative." His 2-page directive calls for the creation of a civilian harm and mitigation response plan in 90 days that will lay out a comprehensive approach to improve the training of military personnel and the collective ensuring of data so that the wrong people don't get killed so often. He also ordered the establishment of a hazily defined Civilian Protection Center of Excellence to institutionalize the knowledge needed to prevent wrongful killings. The underlying idea is that military culture will be changed so that protecting civilians is a core goal. From the beginning, one of the hallmarks of the post-9/11 wars has been the widely reported killing of civilians by U.S. forces. The things have been revealed in exhaustive detail year after year by generations of journalists, as well as non-profit organizations and military whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning and Daniel Hale. There have been a begrudging chorus of admissions by the Pentagon that go back more than a decade. In 2010, the Joint Chiefs of Staff completed its classified Joint Civilian Casualties Study. In 2013, a Pentagon office called Joint and Coalition Operational Analysis published a report titled "Reducing and Mitigating Civilian Casualties: Enduring Lessons." The remarkable thing about that 2013 report, other than the fact that it included most of the remedies Austin mentioned recently, was that it contained a list of a dozen other reports on civilian casualties that JCOA alone had published in the previous 5 years. And 5 years later, in 2018, the Joint Chiefs completed yet another classified report on civilian casualties. The Washington Post, which revealed its existence, described that report as a major examination of civilian deaths in military operations, responding to criticism that the Pentagon has failed to protect innocent bystanders in counterterrorism wars worldwide. Sound familiar? And that secret report came 2 years after President Barack Obama had issued an executive order that said the military was killing too many civilians and needed to take a range of actions to change that. You get the point. The Pentagon's protestations of disappointment at what has happened and its promises to do better are the standard confetti of insincerity. In many ways, it's similar to executives at Facebook expressing dismay and regret at some of the ways their platform has been used and abused, and promising to do a better job. The important thing to watch is not what powerful institutions promise to do, but what they actually do. And when they do nothing after promising again and again to make changes, you will be foolish to regard their latest vow as meaningful. Hena Shemsi, director of the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project, said, "While a serious Defense Department focus on civilian harm is long overdue and welcome, it's unclear that this directive will be enough. What's needed is a truly systematic overhaul of the country's civilian harm policies to address the massive structural flaws, likely violations of international law, and probable war crimes that have occurred in the last 20 years. The best template for understanding The endurance of the Pentagon's failures and civilian casualties might be its record on curbing sexual abuse in its ranks. This is a problem that has existed forever but jumped into the public realm in a particularly strong way with 1991 tailhook scandal, when 83 women and 7 men were sexually assaulted at a Navy conference in Las Vegas. Since then, the military has continually promised to do everything it could to fight sexual abuse. There has been no shortage of studies and plans and hearings, but the problem persists. With nearly 1 in 4 service women reporting sexual assault in recent studies and more than half reporting sexual harassment. There is now hope of real change after Congress finally passed legislation in December that transfers to independent military prosecutors the authority to pursue the assault cases. In the meantime, there is one thing Biden could do that would show the government is just a little bit serious about reducing civilian casualties. Daniel Hale, who pleaded guilty of leaking classified military documents that revealed the scale of civilian killings by U.S. drones, is currently serving a 45-month sentence for violating the Espionage Act. He should be pardoned. To demonstrate that it was terribly wrong to punish someone who tried to stop the murder of innocent people. I stole something that was never mine to take, precious human life, Hale said at his sentencing, adding, I couldn't keep living in a world in which people pretend that things weren't happening that were. Please, Your Honor, forgive me for taking papers instead of human lives.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
It's the 10-day festivities in Iran marking the victory of Islamic Revolution 43 years ago. The country has been through thick and thin in the past 4 decades, facing an imposed war and most cruel sanctions ever imposed on any country in the world. Now, among the accomplishments of the revolution, as Iran's leader has put, mention can be made of achieving independence, safeguarding the country's territorial integrity, the elevation of Iran's status on the international scale, the promulgation of free thinking, and the growth of spirituality.
43 years ago, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country after 14 years of exile. The historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe Fajr, or the 10-day dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic. By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi, and these are our guests for this edition. We'll have Abul Fahd Sajidi, Islamic studies researcher in the Iranian city of Qom. Also joining us in this edition will be Masoud Chajari, the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Let me start with Mr. Sajidi. First things first, let's begin with a look at the roots of the Islamic Revolution in Iran and how it all began. Let our viewers know, what was it that made Iranian people stand up and topple the Pahlavi regime?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Congratulations on the anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution of Iran and the arrival of Imam Khomeini in Iran. The root of revolution is value and Islamic understanding. People in Iran were under the pressure of injustice from Pahlavi regime, who was under the control of USA. You know, as previously, we see that always USA and some foreign countries, they wanted to use Iran for their own benefit. And because of that, we see in Iran, Imam Khomeini started to give enough information to people to understand what is the value of justice, what is the value of morality, because of, on the one hand, they had under the pressure of economical pressure, political pressure, and on the other hand, they saw that Islamic ruling are not applied in the society, rather they are not free to apply them. They are not free to even, they have their own ceremony. The politicians, they were arising, and they, you know, because of that, they saw that even for the Muharram, they were not free to do their ceremony. So these banners, these various aspects of these attacks against Muslims and against this community, Muslim community. So we see that Imam Khomeini started saying that we should be a free country, we should use our own benefits, our own economic, we should make our economic, we should try to develop our country, to use our youth and every capital that we have for our own benefit. Mm-hmm. So because of these limitations, because of these problems that they had, they started to have the revolution. We see because actually if we want to analyze our Islamic revolution right now, if we want, we must examine Iran with the condition of the external enemies and the internal companions of those enemies. So even at that time, and also still, we see the continuation of those unfair and ruthless activities. Right now, unfortunately, still we have an unfair and ruthless enemy. So if we want to analyze our revolution and we are to understand what we have obtained through this revolution, mm-hmm. first,
Let's come to that point at a later time. You just start about the roots, and then we'll go ahead chronologically. Sorry for the interruption. Mr. Shajideh, one major achievement of Iran's Islamic Revolution was gaining true independence from all others and trying to stand on its own feet in the presence of myriad of plots and conspiracies coming its way. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. I think at the heart of the revolution was to free the nation and its population from colonial sort of interest and oppression, which was done through agents like Shah. You know, very much like what is happening now in the region, in Saudi Arabia, in Emirates. You know, individual dictators are doing the bidding of the colonial powers and oppressors for their interests and undermining the interests of their own citizens. This was a revolution to free and give independence and give people power back to the people with and through Islamic understanding. In some ways, it was also revival of Islam and Islam Muhammadi as a sort of concept which liberating the people, empowering people, and indeed dictating and facilitating political, social, economical aspect. You know, let us remember, before the Islamic Revolution, Islam was being seen as an outdated ideology which only belongs to the past. What happened at the time of revolution wasn't what happened just in Iran, but right across the globe. There was a tsunami of people an ideology to address the needs and aspiration, all needs and aspiration, political, mm-hmm. economical, social needs of aspiration, not of just Muslims but others. In South America, people were carrying the pictures of Imam Khomeini and they were identifying with this uprising against the hegemony, US hegemony, which has been oppressing people.
Right.
And I think that is really and Imam said very clearly, to be free, you first have to free your own mind. So decolonizing your mind, empowering, and indeed getting confidence to stand up for your principles was part of this revolution.
Okay. Now, Mr. Sajideh, let's now draw a comparison between Iran's Islamic Revolution and also the revolutions elsewhere in the world. What is it that makes Iran's Islamic Revolution distinct from other revolutions elsewhere?
Well, actually, there are various different differentiation we can make here. One is that Islamic revolution was based on Islamic ideas. They wanted to be able to apply Islamic law in their societies. They want to achieve morality according to what Islam says. They want to achieve Islamic lifestyle. They want to have the culture, make their culture according to Islamic values. So one point is that this revolution is Islamic revolution. So because of that, Islam means that the culture, the economy, the politics, and the social relations, families, education, all these aspects, they wanted to base according to Islamic law and according to Islamic advices. According to Islam, we should, for example, prefer the spirituality over, for example, other aspects. So the spirituality and morality should be growth, we should have a kind of progress in this aspect. So one aspect is the Islamic aspect. And the most of values that we have in Islam, they are human values. There are not something different from others. Rather, according to Islam, we want to refer to our revelation. We want to have our sample, our model, the Ahlul Bayt, Imams, the Holy Prophet, the Imam Hussein, Imam Mahdi, and all infallible Imams. So they should be considered as our model. They are the person who has the best level of morality. So we want to have religion in our life, not only just once a month, for example, once a day we think for our relation to God. No, we want to bring God always to our society. So all right, marriage, social contract, everything, they want to do it according to what Islam says.
Okay. Now, Mr. Shajira, as you know, Iran has been subject to severe Western sanctions all these years, that affecting all aspects of life. And still, lots of scientific and technological advancements have been made, for instance, in nuclear and nanotechnologies, among other things. So what's the secret for this success?
Well, the secret for success is independence, is empowerment, is liberation. And liberation in all aspects. You know, you were saying about different revolutions. Some revolutions was because of sort of reaction against class system. Some were for economical reasons. Islamic revolution was extremely balanced, and it was empowering all people. And, you know, after the revolution, the whole sort of direction of the society changed in such a way which has not been seen anywhere else. And it's that sort of aspect of it which empowered people to achieve all the achievements despite all the sanctions. I mean, really, to achieve what Iran has achieved technologically, it itself on its own is quite a sort of remarkable. But to do it despite all the sanctions, despite the fact that, you know, let's be clear, the whole world united against Iran. The imposed war of Iraq wasn't just Iraq imposing war. It was the whole world. All the Western and Eastern, the Arabs, and everyone was involved in supporting Saddam. Despite all that, the victory came to the Iranian nation. And since then, with all the sanctions, as you said, you know, Iran has achieved in such a remarkable way that is really, it's unbelievable. You know, in the field of education, in the field of empowerment of the women, there are more women in our universities as lecturers and scientists and professors than is in most of the Western world. You know, you could go through all the achievements in all different levels, and you come to the only understanding that all this was as a result of people saying no to the colonialism of United States and neo-colonialism, and getting independent and starting relying on themselves with a huge confidence which Islam has brought to them.
Correct. Now, Mr. Sajidi, on the international front, Iran today is boasting of a lofty position and a status in the world, especially in the West Asia region, as a major player. It's offering assistance to regional countries like it helped Iraq defeat Daesh and others. Those countries are asking for it. Iran is offering them assistance. And Iran is also a source of inspiration for some other countries. Like Mr. Chatter just mentioned, Latin American countries. Let's have your thoughts on these aspects.
Yes. Actually, I think, you know, when we want to analyze Iran, we should understand the present situation, and we should take into consideration the particular condition that we have. Yes, Iran, on the one hand, we had the Daesh, and Iran tried to remove this obstacle. But unfortunately, we see, for example, someone like Soleimani, the martyr Soleimani, has been, we see the sanction of this Soleimani on Instagram and all other mass media. So there is not a kind of justice in the world, unfortunately, against Iran. We see the chemical attack during the 8-year war. Right now we see that the vaccine and drug and medicine, they are the sanction of medicine, the sanction of drug, you know, the sanction of vaccine. These are not something understandable. How we can analyze them according to human understanding? You know, right now we see an extensive cultural war against Iran using cyberspace tools against Iran. We see in such a situation, actually we see that all countries, they are little to little, they are trying to understand Iran. I want to mention, when I was in Canada, there were mass media against Iran so heavy that once when I participated in a demonstration of votes in Canada, I saw one of my classmates who was in Canada, I saw that he also participated in the demonstration. I asked him that, what is the reason that you are participating in such a ceremony? He said, since I had tendency to understand political issues, when I saw that there are so many propaganda against Muslims, against Hezbollah, against Iran, right, I was sensitive to understand. Then I tried to discover, I understood that the truth is vice versa.
Okay.
So if they want to understand Iran also, they are trying to understand in such a way.
Right.
So we are not deep with such, we should say that we are facing an unfair and ruthless enemy right now.
Okay. Now, Mr. Chandra, let's talk a little bit about the way that America has been treating Iran in all those years, since the very first day after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and cite reasons for Tehran having difficulty in trusting Washington's intentions.
Well, I think anywhere around the world, people should not trust U.S. intention. The U.S. is a power, it's a hegemony that oppresses others for the benefit of not just Americans, but the benefit of few in America. I mean, let's face it, United States even oppresses its own people. When you have a situation that 1% of the population owns 85% of power, resources, and the wealth, that means that 99% are being oppressed by that 1%. And the system is geared, system has been fixed to enable this injustice to take place day in, day out. So, you know, this the system in the United States, the legal system, the policing, all these structures are geared, are massaged, are actually created to create and continue that oppression of even Americans, majority Americans. When it comes outside of United States, you know, they use the excuses of we want democracy, and then they promote the apartheid system of Israel or the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia and UAE, when these guys are actually killing each other and their own family, imprisoning them, and there is no democracy, there is no justice.
Okay.
Really, I think I think Iran should be proud that has got the United States as an opponent.
Okay.
And I think Iran...
Chajira, we're out of time, unfortunately. I got to jump in. That's all the time we have. I apologize for that. Abul Fazl Chajira, Islamic Studies researcher, join me from Guam, and Master Chajira, head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London, with their contribution. So I've been your host, Behruz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
Epic. Epic. Glory. Honor. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
In the limelight.
The Islamic Revolution, which continues its inspirational awakening of the masses in the region and beyond, is an undeniable fact, as is evidenced by the positive developments in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Bahrain, Yemen, Afghanistan, Egypt, and Nigeria, to name a few countries. The astounding progress of Islamic Iran in science and technology, that is, medicine, stem cell therapy, the nuclear fuel cycle, aerospace, cyberspace, and artificial intelligence, and all other fields, including profound influence on social, cultural, intellectual, political, and economic events outside the borders of Iran, is proof of the far-sighted vision of Imam Khomeini. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, A Revolution Was Burst of Light. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. February 1st starts the 43rd 10-day dawn in the history of Iran, It means it is now as many years since that memorable day when that sage of the age landed in Tehran to an unprecedented welcome seen anywhere in the world to guide people towards victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the Islamic Republic. Millions of Iranians thronged Mehrabad Airport this day in 1979 to catch a glimpse of the return from almost 15 years of exile of the iconoclast at whose impending arrival the British installed and US-backed Shah had fled the country. No doubt, the enthusiastic masses in Iran sang in the streets via the radio and on the TV. The devil has fled at the approach of the angel. As the international media focused upon the charismatic personality of Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, God bless his soul, expecting some sort of sensation, especially when the apparatus of the Pahlavi regime was apparently intact and thundering threats, the unguarded imam and his millions of unarmed followers neither dug trenches nor went for weapon arsenals. Straightway, he drove to the Behesht-e-Zahra cemetery, which was blooming with more and more new graves every day as the regime continued its killing spree on the orders of its masters in the U.S. He chose the resting place of the seemingly dead to address the apparently alive all over the world where consciences had long frozen, if not become lifeless. Every word he spoke has been diligently recorded and is punctually heard and is screened every year and does not need to be repeated, including his emphasis on establishing the Islamic Republic system of government, his naming of the U.S., the Great Satan, and his promise of support to the oppressed people of Palestine. It is worth recalling that many of the self-acclaimed analysts and politicians around the world had chuckled at the words of the black turbaned and white-bearded religious scholar in his late 70s. They didn't give him much chance of survival, let alone success. They thought he was daydreaming. Most in the West were convinced that soon he would be taken care of by the Shah's U.S.-trained military or pushed into the sidelines by Western-educated and supposedly democratic-minded self-styled revolutionaries who were now pouring into Tehran from Paris, London, Bonn, New York, etc. to take over the country as one of those puppet republics. How utterly wrong they were! The analysts, the politicians, the experts, the Iran watchers, including of the so-called Third World, who saw developments in the world only through the stained glasses of either the capitalist in Washington or the communist in Moscow. No need to recount the spectacular developments of the past 43 years in Islamic Iran, which Imam Khomeini guided through the intensity of the devilish plots of the great Satan, including the 8-year war imposed through Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad. In retrospect, where are today's politicians, analysts, and experts in the West engrossed in the 4+1 talks in Vienna and the useless U.S. sanctions? Like it not, it is crystal clear that the Islamic Republic of Iran is the epitome of practical reality of a sovereign, independent country that has defeated global arrogance. C. Similarly, the Islamic Revolution, which continues its inspirational awakening of the masses in the region and beyond, is an undeniable fact, as is evident by the positive developments in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Bahrain, Yemen, Afghanistan, Egypt, and Nigeria, to name a few countries. The astounding progress of Islamic Iran in science and technology, that is medicine, stem cell therapy, the nuclear fuel cycle, aerospace, cyberspace, and artificial intelligence, and all other fields, including profound influence on social, cultural, intellectual, political, and economic events outside the borders of Iran, is proof of the far-sighted vision of Imam Khomeini. He predicted the end of communism, and it is no more. He foretold the collapse of capitalism, and it is on its last legs in the West. He prophesied the weeding out of the cancer's tumor called Israel, and its death throes are evident for all, despite the desperate bid of the U.S. to prolong its survival through the much-publicized open alliances with the equally precarious Arab regimes. Thus, in a last-ditch effort that speaks of sheer frustration and intellectual bankruptcy of the U.S., its devilish minions, after their utter failure in turning Syria and Iraq into Takfiristan through the most macabrely murderous terrorists, have resorted to state terrorism in Yemen in a hopeless bid to try to undermine the wave of awakening set in motion by the Islamic Revolution. Soon, this will also end in failure. And, as stressed by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who continues to ably guide Iran, inshallah, God willing, the current second 40-year phase of the Islamic Revolution will see more victories, watered by the sacred blood of the martyrs General Qasem Soleimani and Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, as well as those in Mesopotamia, Levant, the Arabian Peninsula, the Caucasus, Central Asia, the subcontinent, Africa, and other places, as the world eagerly awaits the promised new order of the global government of justice to be established by the Savior of mankind, the awaited Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. Didn't the late Imam Khomeini say, "Our revolution was a burst of light"?